everybody. This is Pam, and you're listening to the Occasional Male Podcast. He stutters, she asks him, which can be found on the blog Make Room for the Stuttering at stutterrockstar.com. And it's also always available as a download on iTunes. Today, I have the opportunity and privilege to speak with somebody that I've communicated a lot with online, but have never had the pleasure yet to meet in person. So I'm excited to have Rob on the show today. Hey, Rob, how's it going today?
Hey, Pam, I'm doing well. Hope that you are, too.
I am. I'm excited.
I'm very happy to be on.
I'm really happy that you're here. I'm interested in learning a little bit more about your story and talking about the little bit of a controversial thread that led to me saying, hey, we should do a podcast. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So to get us started, could you formally introduce yourself to us, who you are, where you're from, and what you do to keep busy?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Pam. So my name is Rob Dellinger, and I'm a school speech language pathologist in Raleigh, North Carolina. I work for the Wake County Public Schools here. And I also work as a consultant for my peers when they're working with students who stutter, who have particular challenges that they need to problem solve. And that's one of the favorite parts of my job, is that consulting piece. Mm. And I also live here in Raleigh with my wife and with my daughter, who's in eighth grade. I also have a daughter who just started her freshman year in college up in Virginia.
Oh, exciting, exciting.
Yeah.
So what got you into the school system, and specifically as an SLP?
Well, so the story of me becoming an SLP, there's the story that I like to tell people, that I used to tell like it was the entire truth. And then there's the story that I think reflects more of the real truth. So the story that I used to like to tell was that when I was a journalist, that was my first career. I was a newspaper journalist. And I was really struggling to talk on the phone and to speak and to interview sources for my newspaper stories. And I went to see a speech language pathologist who lived nearby, and he changed my life. He helped me to change my life. And I was so moved that I wanted to go back to school to give back. And so I became a speech language pathologist so I could help other people who stutter. And, you know, I would like to say that, you know, that's the full story. But really, my first job, though, out of school was actually not working with people who stutter. It was in nursing homes. So, you know, I did not really fulfill that dream right away. And I started working in the school system because I lost my job in the first round of Medicaid cuts back in the, you know, the late 90s. So I actually wound up in the school system by accident and had never thought I would ever work in the school system. But now I can't imagine really having spent my career anyplace else. But, you know, I think really the truth of my story would be that I really wanted to be an English professor, but I thought that lecturing in front of a class as a person who stutters just made that not workable. That was not true, of course, but that's what I thought at the time. So I picked journalism, and I thought I would be the next, you know, Bob Woodward at the Washington Post, but that didn't happen for me either. But, you know, I really did struggle, you know, in the job to talk on the phone and to interview sources and to speak up at meetings and all. But, you know, really, I left that profession more to escape my problems and to get out of a very competitive environment and then into a speech language program where I thought that people would be a lot more compassionate, would have a lot more understanding of the problems I was going through. And, you know, it's so funny, it ends up that as a speech language pathologist in the school, like I'm sure that you're aware of working in education, I talk all day long, every day, you know?
I know, and it's funny, right?
it's actually very humorous, you know? And, You know, we have these IEP meetings that are sometimes, not very often, but they're, you know, sometimes contentious and they're very stressful. And so I find myself, you know, speaking in stressful situations quite a bit. So you can run, but you cannot hide from the stresses of life, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I have a bit of a similar story when I was, I was very covert with my stuttering for many, many years. And when it came time for college to, you know, pick my major, my profession, I really wanted to teach. But I thought, well, a person who stutters can't do that. I could not imagine myself being in front of a classroom, being able to manage the classroom, command the respect, etc. So I picked something that I thought would be easier communicatively wise, and I went into social work. And of course, I was completely wrong, because social work, probably I'm talking more than maybe I would have teaching. But now I'm doing something even completely different than that. And like you, I find myself talking every single day. And even though I'm not a certified teacher, I'm actually probably teaching people anyway through what I do and by stuttering openly now. I'm teaching young people about it's okay to be a little different, and we can still be effective communicators. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's wonderfully ironic, isn't it?
It is.
In a beautiful way.
I work in a school, and most of my job entails going around to all of the schools in my territory to do recruitment outreach presentations to get students interested in perhaps doing their last 2 years of high school at our career tech program, so that kids can take CNA, certified nurse assistant, or information technology, or auto technology, or welding, at the same time as they're finishing their high school degree, so that they could, if they want it, when they get out of high school, go right into the work world and maybe not have to start off their life saddled with huge debt, because they can get jobs in these fields without necessarily needing a 4-year degree. So I talk to 15-year-olds all the time about this, and I stutter. So I'm finding myself in that kind of firstly horrifying role of, oh my God, I'm stuttering in front of 15-year-olds, and they're 15 and they're sometimes jerks. But I'm also, you know, educating them about, hey, you know, people who stutter can still do this. And it's kind of a default lucky role that I find myself in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Pam. You've really found your voice, you know, and and that's what we're trying to help young people do, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what's the age of the kids that you work with in your school?
So mostly I work with kids who are in kindergarten through fifth grade. I also work with a few preschoolers, and I do consulting at all levels with my colleagues. Most of my requests come from therapists who work with kids in elementary school, I find.
Okay.
So that is my expertise, is working with elementary school kids, you know, school age kids who stutter. Mm-hmm. And I have some folks I reach out to for support myself in high school and in preschool, since that's not my main area of expertise.
Right.
But, you know, most speech language pathologists who work in the schools, you know, they do not feel like they have the knowledge and experience that they need and the expertise that they need. And, you know, folks are just really, really happy to have someone who they can contact who, you know, who's really passionate about this part of our field.
Right.
Because not everybody is, you know.
Right. I've, in fact, heard and actually talked to a number of SLPs and SLP students who, frankly, seem rather intimidated by working with stuttering because it's not something that you can just fix.
Right.
And there's not immediate progress, perhaps, that you can measure. So I've talked to a lot of SLP graduate students who are frightened by the possibility of working with people who stutter because it's so complex. It's not just what comes out of our mouth. It's all that other stuff, as you know, including the decisions that we make are often dictated by our stuttering, and you got to have some counseling skills, I think, to be successful as an SLP these days. And
it's an absolute necessity, an absolute necessity. You know, in fact, it strikes me that if people who don't have a lot of experience in working with young people who stutter, if they're not intimidated, there's something terribly wrong because it is very intimidating. It is a very challenging problem to treat, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you mentioned, after you were, doing the journalism stint, you found some good speech therapy. Was that it? Had you had any therapy as a kid, or did you just pursue it as an adult?
That's a good question. So I did have school-based therapy when I was in the first grade, and that was not very effective. I have very few specific memories of that time, but the ones that I do have were just awful, you know, just awful memories. And, you know, I don't know that the therapist who worked with me was a terribly skilled therapist in the area of stuttering. Then I had some therapy in probably the third, fourth grade with a wonderful clinician in Gastonia, North Carolina, and his name is Neil. He's still a really good friend of mine to this day. And, you know, that wasn't effective then at the time for a lot of reasons. He was doing really exemplary therapy for the time, what I remember. He was doing everything right. It's just, you know, stuttering is so complex and families are so complex. And it just didn't work at that time to help me become a more comfortable and better communicator. You know, like you, I was very covert. I was terrified of speaking and I was always trying to avoid situations. But he's the person who I came back to actually as an adult when I was working actually in Salisbury, North Carolina, as a newspaper reporter. He's the one who I sought out, and he's the one who I saw as an adult. And then things did begin to stick. The journey certainly did not end there in my, you know, mid-20s. But, you know, that's where it started. And it was a wonderful experience. I think that you were asking about, you know, what was the therapy like? Was that what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Well, it was very integrated, you know, for that time. Still, I think at that time, and this was in the early 90s, I think that most therapists were still very geared toward fluency shaping only, you know, not just as one part of the therapy, but as pretty much all of the therapy or most of it. And so that was a part of the therapy I did. Now, you know, obviously you're hearing me speak and I'm mostly fluent, and that kind of therapy was really effective for me for the motor part of speech. But then, you know, the other parts, the emotional part, the cognitive part were unchanged. I was still very, very raw with, you know, with my emotions and my thoughts. So we did work on that a lot. We did a lot of desensitization work. I would go places and stutter on purpose, and then, you know, we would talk after, we would debrief, and we would make sense of that. And I, you know, learned other kinds of skills and did more counseling things too. So that really planted a seed for later on. But what really stuck with me was the fluency shaping. So that's what I did for myself until my mid-40s, when it just got to the point, you know, with my anxiety and my emotions, that I had to really make a major move and add a lot more to my repertoire, you might say. So that's when I embraced acceptance and commitment therapy, which, you know, that was what else I needed, was to recognize that, you know, it's normal to have anxiety. It's normal to struggle with emotion. Well, maybe not to struggle with, but to have emotions that you don't want, to have contents of your inner experience that we would rather not have to have. And, you know, once we accept that that's just part of being human and we stop struggling with that, then we can work towards the things that we value, the things that give our lives meaning.
Right.
And, you know, having my number one goal in life is not stuttering was just not very satisfying. You know? So that's more the trajectory of my journey, I guess, Pam. What a journey it's been, though.
Yeah, it sounds it. It sounds it. And, you know, I'm just going to piggyback a little. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a similar experience. I did not have any therapy as a child. My father refused to allow me to enter into therapy. I always thought that it was because he was ashamed that one of his kids wasn't perfect. So, you know, it was a taboo. We didn't talk about it. You know, periodically when I would stutter, my father would yell at me and tell me to stop that. And, you know, we don't talk like that. And, you know, so getting a message like that when you're five, that your father doesn't like how you talk, was also one of the things that kind of led me to feel and believe that I need to not stutter so I don't hear that from my father. And I didn't know how to not stutter, so I just didn't talk. So I actually didn't have any therapy until I too was in my 40s. And at 42, I had a very dramatic, pivotal moment in my life, which led me to do some research, find some support, and I realized that there was a therapy program and an NSA chapter right in my backyard, 15 minutes away, and never knew that. So I went into therapy, and they were doing traditional fluency shaping therapy, and it was with graduate student clinicians under, you know, the licensure of SLPs. And it didn't work. It did not click with me, because what I saw was, by having the clinicians teaching me fluency techniques, to me, it felt like, oh, you're just teaching me how to continue to cover it up. And that's not what I needed. I didn't know what I needed. I thought the SLP would tell me what I needed. I came into therapy thinking, well, the SLP is all knowing. They're going to know what to do for me. Here I am, this covert person, and they're teaching me, you know, full breath, easy onset. And I quickly realized, you're just teaching me how to be covert. And that's not what I need. I need to stutter. And that was, I mean, we could talk about that till the cows come home, but that
we sure could. Story. We sure could.
You know, I did not, I felt like they were teaching me how to just continuously perpetuate the fraudulent person I thought I had become. And when I started to express to the clinicians, hey, this isn't working, I'm not feeling this, I don't want to do this, I think we need to let me work on stuttering, I didn't say it in those words. I didn't have that language yet, but they were not interested in that. They were interested in teaching me the gentle onset and the full breath. And so I didn't stay in therapy. I left after a year and a half. So anyway, fortunately, I found support in the NSA and kind of figured out my own ways of coming out of the covert closet. And, I definitely learned a lot from that experience of being locked into fluency shaping, which for covert people isn't always the best way to approach it. But anyway, it's interesting because you mentioned anxiety and, I clearly as well had a lot of anxiety around stuttering as a kid trying to hide it. My college experiences were humiliating. I had a situation where I was forced to do a presentation when I was not ready. And now in the high school that I'm working at, I am part of a team that is focusing on recognizing mental health issues, wellness, and awareness with our high school students, because I live in New York, and New York State is the first to require mental health training and instruction in K through 12. So all of the states, I think, are going to be looking at New York. How are they going to handle this and how are they rolling this out? So I've been involved in a lot of trainings over the summer, and I found this really interesting article, which, you know, I posted it on Facebook.
Right.
And got all kinds of interesting responses. But the article was about how there seems to be more and more middle and high school kids who are legitimately diagnosed with generalized or social anxiety disorders, who are exercising their desire to perhaps opt out of the requirement to have to present in front of a class for a project or an assignment or whatever. And I posted that on Facebook. That's how you and I began communicating. And interestingly, a lot of people were commenting along the lines of, we're raising a generation of wusses and we shouldn't allow kids to have that power to say, I'm not going to do this. And so I'm interested, you know, what your take on that is, because we did have some back and forth on the thread, and I think it's something we should explore in a conversation here.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm really excited about doing that. I think, you know, viewpoint diversity is where you get toward the truth, right? We're not always having to experience our confirmation bias of our own ideas, right? So I think that's a great way to move toward what is, you know, what is true. There's so much to unpack in what you just said, Pam. And I want to go back, and then I'll circle back to the current topic. But I wanted to go back to what you said about the fluency shaping piece for people who stutter covertly. That might not be the best method to start with. And, you know, that might not be for everybody. That's what people feel the most comfortable doing in therapy as far as speech language pathologists, because it's the easiest part of the therapy to do. It's easy to measure. But it's very counterintuitive that success really might mean more stuttering, at least in some parts of your journey, if not, you know, the whole journey for some people. And, you know, I really take care to remember as a speech therapist and as a consultant that what worked for me might not necessarily work for somebody else. You know, fluency shaping was part of the solution, is part of the solution for me, but it's not hardly all the solution. I need a lot more than that to be a healthy, functioning human being. And so it's really important to recognize that. And, you know, you mentioned your experience in your family. Mm-hmm. You know, my experience was not that intense, but, mm-hmm. you know, I certainly, you know, had negative messages that were sent to me from one parent, and then the other parent, you know, they tried to make up for that by saying, oh, you don't really stutter at all. You don't stutter any more than I do. So it both kind of got swept under the rug and picked on a little bit, you know. So I think, you know, I think our parents and, you know, other people who love us, our friends, our speech therapists, you know, I think, you know, they mean well, but, you know, you can easily send the unintended message when you focus only on fluency that stuttering is bad and so are you.
Right.
And it's so easy to internalize that message. I did.
I did,
and
too.
Have spent my whole life untangling that message and learning to believe something that's very different, you know. But, yeah, I think if we only focus on that fluency piece, I mean, it's the obvious thing to do, right? You stutter, so you want to stutter less.
Right.
You're not fluent, so let's teach kids to be more fluent. And it just doesn't work that way. This kind of therapy just doesn't work that way for most people. It's very complex and has to be very individualized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So then getting back to what you were just talking about, as far as, you know, the article, I mean, that really plays into it too. You know, I think a lot of people do respond to information like you're talking about that by saying, oh, you know, we're just raising a generation of victims who, you know, love being victimized and they're wusses, like you said. But I think, you know, whenever you're talking about and approaching people who have serious problems in their lives, we have to start from a place of having compassion for them and for their experience. So, you know, regardless of what you believe is the right way to encourage them to go, you have to start with compassion or you're going to miss the mark, I think. So I think, you know, you and I both have that. So, you know.
And I think my background, having come up from being extremely covert and afraid to stand up and speak for myself, I think we need to be encouraging young people to know how to self-advocate. Because when they get into college or careers and they need extra support or an accommodation, a reasonable accommodation, which by law, people with a disability are certainly entitled to, we need to teach kids how to do that, how to speak up, stand up, and be self-advocates. So it was interesting to me when people responded to my thought that it's okay for kids to self-advocate, that the thread went on about, well, if you do that, you're not preparing them for the real world, and you're kind of perpetuating avoidance. And then you and I actually engaged in, you know, a very productive thread. And then you talk about, right now, you just mentioned, you know, you have to start from compassion.
Yes.
And not everybody does that. So how do we help educators, SLPs, teachers, any adult meet a kid where they're at with compassion? How do we do that?
Well, I think that we can role model that, you know, for one thing. I think it's important to frame the discussion around this topic not in black and white terms either. You know, I think that people tend to think in black and white terms. That's a cognitive, you know, bias that many of us have, is either this or it's that. But it's not an either or black and white situation with students' needs surrounding communication. And, you know, what we can do with accommodations is we can you know, listen to kids and hear what they're saying. We can give them accommodations to meet their needs with the plan that that's not the end game.
Right.
You know, the end game for them is that they won't need the accommodation. And that's the way that I see it as a speech language pathologist. You know, sometimes I do support putting in place accommodations for kids who stutter with the idea that with any luck, these are going to be temporary.
Right.
Because I see it as my job to develop great communicators, whether they continue stuttering or not, and many kids do. You know, it's hard to know who will and who won't. But, you know, regardless of whether they continue to stutter or not, let's teach kids that they can be great communicators. They can be effective communicators. They can become the kind of communicators that they want to be, whether they continue to stutter or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that's the message that I try to send. You know, certainly I wouldn't say that we should never give accommodations to kids. Certainly we should to meet their needs. But let's not stop there.
Right.
One thing that I really focus on, and Pam, I've been really influenced by Kristen Camella here in this area. Do you know Kristen?
I met her at a couple of friends' conferences. So yes, I don't know her well, but yes.
Yeah. Well, I've never met her in person, but we've had a number of exchanges, and you know, she's been very, very influential in my thinking and in my career and in the workshops that I do for my colleagues. You know, she really advocates focusing on communicative competence because, you know, for me, there's no way that competence doesn't matter in the world. You know, it just does.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I really focus on, you know, what's the mindset of an evolving communicator for the kids I work with, which is, you know, usually early and later elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's some areas of focus that I focus on. And, you know, here I'm not just talking about speech therapy, but also how can we use what we know about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT? How can we use what we know about acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT? How can we use what we know about mindfulness? And how can we scale that down to help these little kids?
Right.
You know, and I think that's absolutely critical. And I just can't emphasize the need enough to do that. And these are not my ideas. These are Kristen's ideas, and they're wonderful ideas. But, you know, one of her key concepts is that, you know, we define communicative success in multiple ways so that it's in reach for all of us. You know, we consider the big picture. We start with a differential evaluation for every child. You not just assume, for example, that, oh, well, this kid stutters, therefore we need to do fluency shaping therapy. No. You know, that's not the way. We do a differential individualized assessment that looks not at just the speech motor pattern and its breakdowns, but at the cognitive, and the emotional factors that are at play for any particular child. You know, we have a willingness to keep learning and growing, you know. So the second key concept would be that communicative competency is not perfect for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes we send the implicit message, the unintended message to kids with the way that we do therapy, that the goal is perfection, and that's out of reach for all of us. So, you know, the third concept would be that communicative abilities, that communication competence, that threads through almost everything that's important to us. Into all of our relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important that we not, you know, give up on competence just because someone stutters. You know, you can be a really effective communicator and continue to stutter. You can also improve every aspect of communication. At least many people can.
Mm-hmm.
So the five areas of focus. So what I do, and I love this, I do this at my workshops. I stole this idea from Kristen, you know, who is one of my role models in the field. But just imagine that you take a child's hand and you have the child place the hand on a sheet of paper, you trace it. And then you start writing words in each of the fingers and the thumb. So the first would be attentive. You know, you teach kids to pay attention. It's hard to pay attention. We're always distracted. Thoughts are always popping up. So we teach kids to be more attentive. What's going on around me? But not just that. Am I aware of my thoughts? What's going on in my mind? Am I aware of my emotions? What's my physical body telling me? Am I afraid? Is my threat system getting engaged? You know, so we can talk in scaled terms that are appropriate for children about these things. Am I aware of my listener's body language? And the expressions that he or she has? And really, really importantly, do I recognize when talking is easier and when it's harder?
Mm.
What can I do? You know, am I able to hear it? Am I able to feel it? Rather than, you know, just be panicked and try to run away from it experientially. So that's the first step. You know, then the second one is teaching about becoming more assertive, which is, you know, hard for a lot of people. And, you know, I think it's a particular challenge when you stutter to be an assertive person, to stand up like these young people are doing for their rights, right?
Mm-hmm,
and for
mm-hmm.
Being self-advocates. You know, do I talk if I want to? Do I say what I want to say versus what I think I can say without stuttering? Do I talk for myself? Do I order for myself at restaurants, even if I stutter on the dish that I want? And do I order the meal that I want? Do I self-advocate around communication if I need to?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kids don't know how to do this. We have to teach them how to do this. Am I the first to introduce myself to somebody when I meet them? You know, we can teach them to do these kind of things,
mm-hmm.
To be more assertive, even if they stutter. So I think a third big one is confidence, which is hard for a lot of people to have. I think especially when you stutter, it can be a real challenge. So you can help people learn how to sit and how to stand up tall, you know, with dignity is a word that I sometimes use, you know, stand like a mountain, you know, from the Zen tradition, like a majestic mountain. But, you know, how do I connect with people with my eyes while I'm talking? Do I look away? You know, so many of my students, they look away, not just when they're stuttering, but they're averse to eye contact all of the time, you know, at least at first. You know, how do I know how to make a first impression? Do I know how to look at someone and greet them and introduce myself to them? So many of our kids, not just our kids who stutter, but a lot of kids lack these basic skills of having and showing confidence,
mm-hmm.
you know. Is my voice strong from the beginning to the end of the sentence, even if I stutter sometimes? Or, you know, so these are all important things to teach kids. So the fourth one would be effectiveness. And, you know, this means, am I getting my message across? Is what I intend to be communicating getting across to the people who are listening to me? So am I moving towards communication rather than away from it? And this, you know, this addresses the covert stuttering issue. And here I think is where we can get into some stuttering modification, into some fluency shaping. Am I able to use greater ease if I try?
Mm-hmm.
You know, have I learned some ways to do that if that's important to me? Am I saying complete sentences or, you know, just a few words because I'm afraid I'm going to stutter if I say a whole sentence? You know, basically, does the way that I'm approaching talking, is it helping the people who are listening to me focus on my message?
Mm.
And you know, that's something that we can scale down even to young elementary kids. The fifth one is how to be proactive. And this, you know, this is the hardest one for my students to understand, you know, but eventually they get it. And, you know, this is about, so do I know how to set myself up for success as a communicator, even if I continue to stutter sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's on my team? Who are the people at my school, in my family, who are on my team, who know that I'm trying to become a better communicator and who know how to help me? You know, we have to train more than just the child, right? We have to train a lot of people in how to be supportive. So do I know what my goals are? Can I, you know, give you the kid-friendly version of my IEP goals?
Mm-hmm.
If they can't, you know, if I ask them, you know, so what are we working on in speech language therapy? We play games. You know, they've missed something, you know. They also have to learn how to ask for feedback. How am I doing? You know, in what ways am I becoming a better communicator?
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, it's just wonderful to listen to my kids talk about that, you know. Hey, I noticed that you were using really good eye contact that time. You were, you know, looking at everybody, not just Mr. Dellinger, but you were looking at me too. And, you know, they have these wonderful conversations, giving supportive feedback to one another. And do I know how to give self-feedback rather than, oh, I'm just awful because I stutter? Well, you know, that time I had a block on this word. So what can I do next time to see if I can work through that a little bit more easily? You know? So these five aspects of overall communication competence, I think we can scale down for kids. We can teach them how to talk with each other and with themselves in these really productive ways that don't just boil success down to whether you stuttered or not. And they learn to be proud of themselves for being great communicators, not for whether they stutter or not. That's my basic approach, and that's what I'm trying to sell to my colleagues. So thanks again to Kristen Camella for these ideas. These are not mine, but I wholeheartedly endorse them.
Wow, it sounds like your approach to therapy with younger children is very comprehensive. And I wonder if I had had an approach like that, would my journey have been different and easier, perhaps?
Yeah. You know, I think if I had had therapy like that too, that my life might have been very different. You know, I suspect that we would have had a different arc, you know, to our lives. I certainly think that that's a probability. Well, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, one of my students who I'm working with, and she's in upper elementary grades now, but I met her when she was in kindergarten. It was toward the end of her kindergarten year, and her teacher didn't recognize at first that she was a child who stuttered. She just knew that she was a child who was very talkative, and then she would just stop talking and put her head down. And she had this pattern, and this is actually true. You know, to the best of my ability to figure this out, to get to the bottom of this, this was actually true. She would be very social. She was a social butterfly at times. You know, she would talk with her friends. And then you know, what was happening really was that she would have a severe block. Then she would put her head down on her table, and sometimes she wouldn't say another word all day. So we placed her toward the end of her kindergarten year. And, you know, we use this very integrated approach. I certainly did not start with fluency shaping. You know, sometimes we do with young children, not for her. You know, we did, you know, a very thorough evaluation and found out that that was not the way to go. So we basically worked on her attitudes about communication and herself as a communicator. And we sent the unequivocal message that, you know, it's okay to stutter. It's okay to talk. It's always okay to talk whether you stutter or not. You're a really smart girl. I want to hear what you have to say. It's important to me. And this approach has just worked wonders with, with her. You know, she got to a point when she was doing more reading aloud in class that she was doing great in most areas of her life as a communicator, but the oral reading, you know, for people who stutter covertly, that oral reading piece is just horrible, you know, and just horrible. And I actually have a little story about that. Maybe we can hear that later. But, you know, so she would just opt out of the oral reading, or she would just read a few words and then stop. And she was so anxious. So we worked on that in speech, and, you know, we worked on all five of the ways that people can be a great communicator. We did use some fluency shaping. We did use a smooth start. So we really broke down what that was and how it wasn't perfect. I didn't expect her to be perfect. This is something that might help you some of the time. Here's how it works. Here's why you use it. Here's when, under what circumstances you use it. Let's give it a go. So we started at one level and we scaled it up and we made it more and more challenging as we went up, but really trying to help her be successful at every level. So, you know, now she sees her oral reading as a real strength, and she'll raise her hand in class, and she'll always volunteer to read and love to do class presentations. You know, so I would like to think that, you know, the way that we structured therapy, the approach that we took, was where the magic happened. And, you know, I really imagine that if she had just had a fluency shaping only approach, that things might not have gone as well for her. And you know, she still struggles sometimes with her speech, as is it expected. That's completely understandable based on what we know about the condition of stuttering. But she is becoming a fantastic communicator, an exemplary one. You know, so So you're talking more about high school kids.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The article, you know, so I'm thinking about, you know, paving the way, you know, what's the expression? You know, you prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child, right? So,
right.
You know, ideally, I think that, you know, my goal is really to prepare the child for what's often a rough road in life. Mm-hmm. And here's all these tools that you can use. And so you learn to recognize that you're anxious, but that doesn't have to stop you from doing what you value, what you want to do, what's meaningful. You can just recognize, oh, you know, that's something that's coming up. Okay, I'll be anxious and I'll go on and do this. And I have this structure in my mind, these five ways to be a great communicator that can help me evaluate how I'm doing. And right. I always know that, you know, Mr. Dellinger's on my side, you know. But so we're talking, though, about kids who have gotten to high school who have not had these kind of experiences where people have taught them acceptance and commitment therapy and, you know, all these wonderful things that we have in our tool belt to teach. They haven't been the beneficiary all the time of this kind of therapy, this kind of intervention, this kind of teaching. So what do we do?
Right.
What do we do? And I think, you know, what we don't do is we just lack compassion and say, oh, you know, just get over yourself. Just go do it. You'll thank me later. No, because then what happens is like what happened to you. Then you have such a traumatic experience that it sets you back for two decades. Mm-hmm. And that can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it does happen. So I think we have to have a lot more skill in our approach, and we have to scale things for kids. And we have to provide accommodations that they need while understanding that if we just stick with experiential avoidance, at least, well, just to back up a little bit. So according to the basic tenets of psychology, right, helping people with anxiety disorders avoid the things that they fear is a misguided approach, because ultimately it just leads to more fear and more anxiety in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the path that you and I took meant more talking and facing up to more anxiety, not less.
Right.
And now that we're sort of on the other side of that in some ways, though I always experience anxiety when I speak, even, you know, while talking to you, this is not entirely a comfortable situation for me. But it's so meaningful and so valuable. I'm willing to be a little nervous, you know, to do this. And, you know, kids can learn that. But we, you know, we start at one place. And then we help them to scale up and, you know, slowly go up that ladder of the things that they're anxious about and that they fear, and slowly overcome those fears, you know. Mm-hmm. But you don't take somebody, you know, for example, who has a horrible phobia of spiders and then, you know, dump a box of spiders on them and suddenly they're cured, right?
Right,
you know, then
right.
They're traumatized. It's slowly, one graduated step at a time. So would you agree with that generally, Pam, or am I off base here in
no,
your opinion?
I agree. And, you know, for those listening to our conversation who might not be aware of the example that I shared with you via a video that I posted, you know, I did have a very humiliating experience in college where, having been covert for, you know, most of my life up until my third year in college, I was told I was going to need to do a presentation in front of my class, small class, there was only like 20 students and the professor, but because I stuttered covertly, it was very anxiety producing for me. And in fact, I had obsessed about it for weeks and had worked myself up to a panic. So I, which was very uncharacteristic for me, went to my professor and said, look, I think I'm going to have a problem with this. I'm requesting, is there some other way that you could perhaps assess my knowledge of the topic rather than make me present in front of the class? And the professor said, no, You either do it or you take a zero. So I felt backed into a corner. And of course I did not want to take the zero. So I did the presentation and it was horrible because I was reading from notes, not verbatim, but I was referring to notes and I stuttered on just about every word. And when I glanced up occasionally, I saw the looks on my classmates' faces and my professor's face, and it was humiliating. They looked pained to be listening to me. And that further intensified the feelings that I already had about feeling so vulnerable in front of the class. So when it was over, finally, I had tears welling up in the side of my eyes, and I bolted from the room. And I went into the bathroom next door and had a full-blown panic attack, breathing into a brown paper bag on the toilet in the stall of a bathroom. And I will always remember that because nobody came to check on me. Nobody came to see, well, where did she go? Is she okay? She just did this presentation and now she's gone. So I think, I know that that experience led me further into the deep dive that I took with trying to hide my stuttering at all costs. And I think had that teacher, professor, recognized that I was showing courage by asking for help and been compassionate just a little bit and tried to work with me and recognize that it took a lot of guts on my part to ask for that help. Yes. I may not have had that experience that took me 20 years to recover from. So I say all that to say this. Yes, what you shared makes absolute sense. We need to help kids not avoid completely, but perhaps offer some hierarchical type of activities. Like in my school, if a kid has a bona fide anxiety issue, as part of their IEP and their accommodation, we may let them present to just the teacher and two trusted friends. And then the next time, increase that to five friends. And then the next time, hopefully, to the whole class. So there is that hierarchical sense of, we're not going to let you opt out of this completely.
Yeah.
Because that's not teaching you how to be prepared for life after high school. And I think that that, as you said, starts with compassion, meeting the child, the kid, the college student, where he or she is at, and then assessing what's in the best interest of that child, whether it's stuttering or an anxiety disorder. I don't think that we're wussing them out by allowing an accommodation, which, at least in my state, New York state law says we must accommodate for a disability. But it's how we structure that accommodation, I think, nullifies the possibility of it being lifelong avoidance. And I think that what you suggest as an SLP, I mean, you're right on the mark, obviously, but I don't think that all SLPs do that.
Well, I would agree with you. I don't think that everyone knows how to do that. So, you know, that's one of my missions in my consulting role and in my workshop leader role, is to spread that message. You know, and it sounds like, despite our differing viewpoints in the Facebook exchange, it sounds like we're, you know, pretty much, you know, sharing the, you know, the same view. So much there that you said of value that deserves to be unpacked, but I'll just speak to courage. I think that courage is really under-recognized and under-reinforced. We need to be reinforcing every act of courage. That is what is going to propel these kids forward into being more competent in life.
Yes.
And you have to have courage, you know, and you simultaneously can have courage and great fear and anxiety and trepidation. And, you know, the courage is what pushes you along toward what you value and what matters and toward your goals. So I always, you know, and I'm certainly not perfect and I don't always do it well, but I always try to reinforce courage whenever this arises. You know, it's really important that we learn how to do this. So as far as how we structure, you know, the activities to both to accommodate kids where they need these accommodations, but to help move them forward. You know, one way that I do it in speech therapy, and this is probably very different than what you would need to do at a high school level, but let's say that, you know, most people who stutter, it seems, have trouble saying their names, at least from time to time, you know, and some of my kids are really reluctant to introduce themselves. That's a skill that I think that we've lost. Mm-hmm. You know, most of my students, whether they stutter or not, they don't know how to introduce themselves. They don't know how to introduce other people, how to greet someone and make a first impression, you know?
Right. So these are using their phones all the time.
Precisely, right. Precisely. But I submit that those skills are still really necessary in the workplace where social media is not going to be the currency, you know, where you still have to have some face-to-face or otherwise person-to-person communication. You know, so for example, when teaching a child how to introduce himself or herself, I might have the child just to introduce herself while sitting down at her usual spot at the table, say, and maybe just say a few words. Well, you know, then next time maybe we'll say more words while sitting in the same seat, at the usual seat, you know, then maybe next time, you know, we'll say a whole sentence. And then the next time we'll stand up and do it. That's a level two. You know, level one is sitting down. Level two is standing up. You know, then there's level three where you walk up in front of the group, you know, and then there's level four when somebody else comes in, another trusted adult comes in. So I have this little hierarchy that I get the kids to buy into, you know, and so they can see and they can check off where they are on the hierarchy. They can see their courage growing. They can see their success growing. Right. You know, they keep checking off things. And, you know, before long, they're standing up in front of their classroom and they're giving the presentation.
Right.
So I think and I hope that by starting early, we can head off some of these problems that we have with experiential avoidance.
Right. Right. That I see when they get to me in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the key is, what do we do now?
Right.
You know,
right.
What do we do now with these kids? And, you know, I think that where we differed on the Facebook exchange was like our bias one way or the other, you know, and maybe, you know, my bias would be in, you know, really encouraging kids to go step by step and try to need fewer accommodations and try and do more with support, you know, with guidance and with support and with the proper kinds of feedback. And, but, you know, it's always a case-by-case individual situation, too, that requires compassion.
Right.
For sure.
Right. And I think that's, you know, the crux of the matter here. You know, the adult in the child's life, whether it be a teacher, a counselor, a mental health professional, an SLP, you have to meet the kid where they're at. And generally, yes, that requires compassion of some sort. And I think if we can do that, that's half the battle, at least in my opinion. And I'm not a professional anything. I'm, you know, I'm a professional person who stutters.
Well, you're a professional advocate for the stuttering community. That's what you are. Yeah.
But you know, we are running out of time, and I suspect that we could probably go on for hours and hours here. But
Easily.
yeah, and this has been a fantastic, important conversation.
I think
So
so
I just
too.
want to wind down with a final question. How does an SLP in a school who is not comfortable or familiar with stuttering find a consultant like yourself who is?
Well, I think it's never a bad idea to reach out to the community of folks who have real expertise in stuttering, and those are the board certified specialists in fluency. Now, I am not yet one. That is a goal of mine to have. But those are people with a wealth of information. And I think that most people are open, to sharing information, to giving feedback. There are also some wonderful publications that you can go to. Scott Yarros has written some wonderful books on school age and on preschool stuttering. So if you look him up online, there are some publications, there are some materials that are really, really helpful. So if you want to learn, you definitely can.
Well, my gosh, we've covered a lot of ground, and I thank you so much for being a guest today. This has been informative and inspiring and a learning experience. So thank you for sharing and being so willing to give of yourself here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come on. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I think it's been really productive, and I'm learning too, so thank you.
You're welcome. And this has been He Stutters, She Asks Him.
Thank you.